You're listening to the New City Church podcast. These episodes are recorded live on Gadigal land. Sometimes the audio quality might not be perfect because what you're listening to is a conversation. We don't edit out the chatter. We think that's what makes it authentic. Wherever you're tuning in from, we hope you find this episode encouraging.
We have a good stash of optimists in the room. I've been told that I am optimist to the point of being toxic. I'm just throwing that out there. I can take a compliment as well as the next person. But I found these graphs incredibly interesting. I came across this book called Factfulness a little while ago. It is a very good book. And it goes through, I guess, the misconceptions that we have as humanity. We have a natural negativity bias. Psychologically, we love the negative. It gets us going, gets our heart rate up. We love the feeling of our heart rate being up. And so we are drawn towards it. But this physician and statistician says that actually we're doing better than we think. We often just don't recognize it. So I'm going to show you just a series of graphs that Hans Rosling has shown. Here's deaths per battle, and these are updated to 2016, but he did just release 2023 figures, and most things are even better, surprisingly. Battle deaths, we're tracking very well. Even when you consider what is currently happening in the world, historically, we're doing actually quite well. Children dying as a percentage has steadily tracked down. We have fewer children dying than ever before in history. That's a good thing, just so we're all on the same page. Child labor has also steadily tracked down since 1950. Deaths from natural disasters, even with climate at its peak at the moment, when more disasters are happening more frequently and with greater severity, number of deaths per year has been tracking down really nicely. Yay, go us. Hunger, and so as a share of people who are malnourished, 1970 we had 28% of the world population. Heading into, it looks like maybe 2015 there, it was at 11%. So that's tracked steadily downward. There is a little blip of that, I believe, at the moment. That's gone up, but certainly nowhere near 1970 position. And the expense of solar panels just keeps going down, which is a nice... So this is negative things that are happening less. That's that. Here's another lot of graphs. These are positive things that are happening more. Child cancer survival is going up. Democracy is far higher today than it has ever been. You can question what democracy looks like, but as a standard. But even so, it is far more positive than historically it has ever been. Girls in high school, 90%. That's a really significant figure. The cereal yield, so harvests, our ability to feed humanity is going up. Literacy is going up. I don't know how you feel when you look at these graphs. My initial instinct is to say, yeah, but what about all the bad ones? There's lots that isn't listed there. I encourage you to go away and read this book and then jump on a site called Gapminder. And take a look and just have a play around with the data, because there's so much good stuff that is happening in the world at the moment. Hans Rosling's slogan that he says throughout it is, things can be bad and getting better at the same time. Those two things can be true. And one of the things that we know is that we have this constant steady stream of media, of social media, of news that heightens the negative, that washes out the positives. And so as we sit in this, the optimist in me says, oh, maybe things are getting better. Maybe we're okay. But then I feel like if I was to put that on X or Twitter, I'd get shot down. Hey, the world is what it is. I want us to sit in this idea as we finish revelation, because I think as people who are exploring faith together, one of the responsibilities that we have, maybe one of the honors, it's a dubious honor at best sometimes, but I think one of the callings that we have on our life is to point to the good things that God is doing in the world, to draw out the goodness, to highlight that without being ignorant of the nuance, without being ignorant of the harm, but to highlight some of those positives because we live in light of resurrection and we are resurrection people. And so when we see resurrection, we should be the first to call it and name it as good. So that's my thesis. That's my idea I want us to track with as we land this revelation plane. We may or may not agree by the end of it, but this is a quote that I quite like from Hans Rosling. He says, "People often call me an optimist because I show them the enormous progress they didn't know about, but that makes me angry. I'm not an optimist. That makes me sound naive. Yeah, I'm not an optimist either. I'm a very serious possibilist." I love that. I'm a serious possibilist. That's something I made up. It means someone who neither hopes without reason nor fears without reason, someone who constantly resists the overdramatic worldview. As a possibilist, I see all this progress and it fills me with conviction and hope that further progress is possible. This isn't optimistic. It's having a clear and reasonable idea about how things are. It is having a worldview that is constructive and useful. I think the revelation worldview is constructive and useful. That's my landing point. I think the revelation worldview is a possibilist worldview. It says, yes, things are hard, but there is a possibility that things are going to land well, and that possibility should spur us into action. Does that make sense? Shall we jump into the last bits of Revelation together? Revelation ends really beautifully. It ends really, really hopeful, optimistic, if you will, maybe possibilist is a better word these days. But that's chapter 21 and 22. We're not there yet. We're in chapter 17, and it's about to get as dark as it gets. We've already been through some darkness in Revelation, but let's do it. It's about to get even darker. This is a nice picture. This is a wood cutting from Martin Luther's Bible. So Martin Luther was a reformer. In 1540, he printed a Bible, and this was an image that came alongside Revelation chapter 17. We have already been introduced to the big red beast here last week. Beth spoke about the beast. That beast has seven heads and 10 crowns. In other words, it is mighty, it is powerful, and the people of earth have given it authority. And the beast in Revelation represents the empire. It's referred to in Revelation as Babylon, but that's a reference to the Hebrew scriptures. And what we actually think John is speaking about is actually saying Rome. That's a bit of a code word to say Rome, this evil empire, the overlords who are here, and that the beast represents Rome. Interestingly, in Revelation, there's lots of things that get crowns. People get crowns, the beast gets crowned, this beast gets 10 crowns. And in Revelation 16 and 17, Jesus comes along and it just says Jesus has many crowns. It's as though Jesus wins by sheer numeracy. Like, he had the most crowns, therefore he's the best. This beast is about to get destroyed, but something has to happen first. And it's a little bit problematic. I'm going to warn you at this point, there's some problematic language throughout this. John isn't afraid to swear in Revelation. He throws it out there. He also is situated in a first century worldview when it comes to gender norms. So I'm gonna caveat as we go in, and I wanna speak about that a little bit. And I also wanna be honest and come clean to say, I really don't understand Revelation. So sorry about that. Having been through 6 weeks and read a huge amount on Revelation, I get to this point and I'm like, wow, it just gets more and more confusing. I think I get chunks of it, then other chunks I'm like, meh. I don't know what the Holy Spirit's trying to say here, but I'm just going to come at it and say, you know, as someone who speaks and reads widely, I don't fully grasp it. Make of that what you will. Maybe I'm a terrible pastor. But it's confusing. It's first century apocalyptic literature that we don't fully grasp. So I want to honor that and just say that I don't have the answers in this situation. But if we go back to this beast, we saw last week that the world has now been divided into two in John's vision. There are people who have the mark of the beast, and there are people who have the mark of the lamb. The mark of the beast is that 666 that often gets spoken about. It was written on their forehead and on their hands. And I wonder, here's an interesting tidbit for you. I wonder if it's a reference to the Levitical laws and the Pharisaical laws that eventually popped up, where the priests in the temple had to wear a phylactery. Anyone know what a phylactery is? Sounds like something rude, doesn't it? It was a little box on their forehead. And in that box was a little scroll, and on the scroll was the Shema. The Shema comes from Deuteronomy. It says, "Hear, O Israel, Yahweh, the Lord our God, is one. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one." So it's a declaration that we are on God's side. Our allegiance is with Yahweh. So I wonder if that is also what that mark is representing. You are either on the side of the beast or on the side of God. Remember, Revelation splits the world into two, always. Good, evil, dark, light. It's just the type of literature. Sitting on the beast is a new character. We haven't met this character yet in Revelation. This is the final character that we're going to meet. And that character is riding atop the beast on here. It kind of looks like she's riding it like a horse. But in chapter 17, we read that this woman has a label, and the label that's written on her forehead and on her thigh is Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes, and the abomination of the earth. That's the label that this woman has. She's in scarlet, dressed in scarlet, and there's four things that you need to know about this character. The first one is she's drunk. She's absolutely sloshed. So I don't know how she's riding the horse, but she's there drunk. But she's not drunk on alcohol. She's drunk on blood. She's drunk on the blood of the church. In other words, she has committed huge violence and killed a number of the believers. And so when the people read this, instantly they say, oh, this person is evil. This person, this figure has killed our family and friends. So that's the first one, she's drunk. Secondly, she's holding a cup. You might be able to see that in the image here. She's holding a cup, and that cup is full of many other abominations. And this is in Revelation 17. Third thing, she gets an identity. Not many figures in Revelation get a really clear identity, but she does. She is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. That's her name, the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. Most likely, John was talking about Rome here, that great city. The fourth thing that you need to know about her is that she's about to be dead, even when we meet her. She doesn't last very long. The nations, and indeed the beast itself, are about to turn on her and kill her. I told you it was about to get dark. They're about to turn, even the beast who she has aligned herself with, the beast who she thinks will keep her safe, the beast who she has fed into and that she gets stuff out of, the beast itself is about to kill her. And you see all the kings that are running towards her. these kings that propped up the beast, they're also about to turn on her. And it's about to be a bloodbath. In other words, Rome is about to fall. That's the precipice that we're at in Revelation. This city that everyone speaks so highly of, that is actually deeply oppressive, is about to be conquered. Now, I want to pause there because the way that this woman is spoken about is, we might use the word sex worker these days. The NIV talks about the prostitute. The way that it's spoken about in Revelation, it's more punchy, it's graphic. And Robin Whittaker, who we heard from the first a few weeks ago, and many feminist scholars actually, would go and use the word whore about this woman deliberately, provocatively. And I want to read something from Robin Whittaker because I think that it puts it really well. These few chapters of Revelation are deeply problematic for the modern reader because they seem to endorse patriarchal stereotypes regarding women's sexuality and purity. John, the author of Revelation, utilizes gender stereotypes of virgin, which we saw a couple of chapters ago, and whore to offer readers a choice between God's empire and the Roman Empire. One is good and pure, in quotation marks, while the other is corrupt and dirty, and therefore deserving of sexualized violence by those who desire her. That should sit really uncomfortably with us. And for those who desire Rome, because she initially, that is the woman who is in red there, because she initially appears beautiful and rich, John's vision reveals her to be a bloodthirsty whore. The challenge for the modern reader, for you and I, is somehow to appreciate that there is a legitimate critique of empire and its injustice here, but it comes wrapped in ancient cultural norms relating to women's bodies, the control of their bodies, and male-centered ideas that assume women exist for male sexual pleasure. Despite this, at the heart of the message of these chapters is a challenge to readers not to desire what looks shiny and bright, because it's not actually of God and comes at a cost to others, and to withdraw from systems of inequality and oppression. Does that make sense? I want to honor the fact that John's writing here is viscerally uncomfortable for me to read it because of the patriarchal world that it sits in. But Robin Whittaker is asking us to look in that context and say, well, what is the point that Revelation is attempting to make here? And I think a wise reading of Revelation means we need to recognize those cultural norms and assumptions, call them out, and seek to understand if there is a deeper message here that spans across cultures and times. Is there one? I feel like I've done a mediocre job of explaining that because I understand it in a muddled way myself. But any questions or thoughts about that, where we're up to so far? Shall we keep going? The underlying message that Revelation is giving for us here, I think, is embodied somewhat in this picture. You'll notice that the woman here who represents Rome, who represents the empire, the oppressor, and is about to fall, she is wearing a hat. Does anyone recognize that hat? I'd be surprised if anyone did. This is the papal tiara. It was worn by the Pope, the Catholic Pope, from about 800 through to about 1200 AD. And Martin Luther has gone ahead and put it on the head of the woman. little jab there. Jab. What Martin Luther was doing, and Martin Luther was a reformer, so this is 1540, this is when the split happened between the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church. Martin Luther was looking at the Catholic Church and he was saying, there is so much about you that is unjust. There is so much about you that is oppressive. There is so much about you that is misrepresenting God. We could say the same thing about many Protestant churches these days. There is so much about you that has your finger on the little guy and you are seeking power. You remind me of someone. You remind me of the whore that killed all those first century Christians. That's what you remind me of, Martin Luther was saying. And it's supposed to be jarring. It's supposed to be gut-wrenching. We're supposed to look at it and say, wow, how on earth could the Catholic Church get to this point? As somebody who has existed within Protestantism for a long time, I want to turn the same lens to all different parts of Christianity. I want to turn that lens to all portions of power in society. I want to take a look at this figure and say, well, where is oppression taking place? Where is harm being caused? Where is death flowing? I think Martin Luther was tapping into something of the prophecy here and recognizing that it wasn't just about first century Christians under the oppression of Rome. This prophecy moves on and on through church history, and it's been interpreted over and over and over again to say there are many different forces, there are many different powers at play which cause pain. It's not just Rome. Rome has become emblematic of something far deeper. And even in the midst of darkness, even in the midst of this figure ruling, there is hope on the horizon. And I think that's where Revelation starts to land. Revelation 17 sets up this city, Rome, this woman as all-powerful. By the end of Revelation 17, she's dead. Revelation 18 and 19 are essentially a song to say Babylon, Rome, has fallen. And then there is a big judgment. And the serpent, the big evil beast, is thrown into the abyss. And there's all sorts of judgments that happen throughout Revelation 18 and 19. We'll come to those in a little bit. But then the good stuff appears. Shall we read some of this? We've turned a corner. In Revelation 21, then I saw, says John, a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, look, God's dwelling place is now amongst the people, and God will dwell with them. They will be God's people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. Last week we spoke about that rapture theology, which says all of the Christians get whisked up into heaven. That's not Revelation. Revelation, God comes down. God tabernacles. God makes God's presence amongst the people. The one who is seated on the throne says, I am making everything new. Then he said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. He said to me, it is done. Do those words sound familiar? It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty, I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. Sounds like John, doesn't it? The book of John. Those who are victorious will inherit all this, and I will be their God, and they will be my children. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, those who practice magic arts, the idolaters and liars, they will be consigned to the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death. One of the seven angels, who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues, came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb." And he carried me away in the spirit to a mountain great and high and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. It shone with the glory of God, and its brilliance was like that of a very precious jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. It had a great high wall with 12 gates and with 12 angels at the gates. On the gates were written the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. There were three gates in the east, three to the north, three to the south, three to the west. And the wall to the city had 12 foundations. And on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. This is a complete city. It's full, it's whole, it's holy. And finally, the angel showed me the river of the water of life, as clear as... I love this picture. This image gets me as I read it. As clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. On each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. It's a glorious picture that Revelation gives us, that hope is on the horizon. That hope is coming even in the midst of darkness. Now, I want to pause just for a moment and ask, can we talk about hell? Are we allowed to say that word? You will have noticed who gets in. Those who are victorious will inherit all this. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, those who practice magic arts, all the lies, they'll be consigned to the fiery lake of burning sulfur. Revelation has long been used as a drawing point for the church's theology of heaven and hell, indeed for the church's theology of salvation. I want to problematize it a little bit and say we can't make really neat assumptions here. Because I think it's important to do. There's lots that we could talk about, but I just want to bring up a couple of things. The first one is the assumption that here, or Revelation indeed, is talking about eternal conscious torment, if that makes sense to people. The idea that hell is forever and the people who are there live forever, I don't think that can be drawn from Revelation. As a concept, it's a pretty clear idea within Revelation that there is a burning place that goes for eternity, but everyone gets thrown there, disappears. They get burnt, like what happens with a fire. You throw something in the fire and it burns up, it no longer exists. So if we were to draw our theology of heaven and hell from Revelation, I don't think that you could land at an eternal conscious torment idea. That's just one thing I want to put in the mix. The second one I want to throw in the mix is there are far greater problems when it comes to reading our salvation idea from this passage in Revelation, and that is, how are we saved in the first place? It is certainly not because I am a wonderful person. It's certainly not because I have done all the good things in the world. Here, it seems to be that the bad people, those bad people, the ones who've done bad stuff, they're the ones who end up in this image of hell. And the good ones, those of us who've done good stuff, we end up in this new city. Now, that is problematic. That is perhaps even more problematic than the rest of it. So, all that to say, I am very hesitant to draw my theology of salvation, also my theology of heaven and hell, from a really symbolic, apocalyptic few chapters. Does that make sense? I'm just very hesitant to do it. There's plenty other places where we can flesh it out, but this isn't the place to do it. It's also important to note that the other places don't talk about fire and brimstone. So if we're not drawing our picture of hell or the afterlife from here, then we need to get rid of that image because it's so unbelievably damaging. I can imagine, because of curiosity, you're like, well, what does Joel believe about heaven and hell? And the honest truth is, I don't know. I don't think that I have enough data to land at it. I have a series of passages that I hold in high esteem that I really want to honor. And when we get to it all, I hold those in tension with a whole series of passages which talk about God drawing all things unto himself. And I hold those in tension to say, when we die, is there a heaven and a hell? I do believe that there is a new creation. I don't personally have any qualms with that. Is there a place of eternal conscious torment? I don't know. I don't have enough data. That's where I sit. One thing that I'm very firm on is, and this is why I can't comfortably call myself a universalist, that word that was used before, that is everyone gets to heaven. I can't yet believe in a God who will force people to be in God's presence, such there is choice. I believe in a God who gives humanity the option, such that if they would like to go a different path, they are free to do so. And if that means not being in the presence of God, then that is an option that is given to people. So that I don't know, does that feel confusing enough for you? Welcome to my brain. And if that is and a conversation that you want to have more of, I'm very happy to have. For me, knowing that God is a God of love and a God of grace just comes back over and over and over again. Okay, are we ready to land this revelation plane? Let's do it. There's been some turbulence on the way, but I hope that it has been healing and hopeful for you. Here's some words from Safina Stewart, who a lot of you would have seen at the Future Church Conference. Safina Stewart is an Indigenous Christian leader and an artist. She says, there is an ancient story that is still being written. The Bible tells us of the story of how sin has created brokenness in our relationships to God, to one another, and to the creation itself. This brokenness goes against the Creator's very intention and design for all things, against shalom, rest, and safe, beautiful, life-giving connections. And yet, our loving Creator longs for reconciliation. You and I are called, I find that word called funny, we're invited into, we're given the task of, perhaps. We're called to be part of God's work to renew and make good. Last year's referendum and the public dialogue that played out was devastating for so many. Not only for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, but also for the millions of people who listened deeply, then walked alongside First Nations peoples for voice and justice. I want to encourage you with the same words my elders and old people spoke to encourage me. This is what they said. We've been here before. This disappointment, this continuing injustice is not new. In fact, it's the most familiar story to us. Despite your sadness, despite this obstacle, you are standing with people, you are standing with a people who are both strong and resilient. And this is not the end of the story. Hope cannot be killed, I believe, because Jesus cannot be killed. So here's two questions that I sit with as I picture that new city, the new Jerusalem that comes with Jesus as the reigning king. First one, where do I see hope? And the second, where am I seeking courage to resist systems of evil and oppression in anticipation of God's new world? Again, Robin Whittaker, she's so good. If you haven't read her book, Revelation for New People, you're missing out. She says this, to live with hope is not to live without despair. They're two sides of the same coin. Indeed, hope is required precisely in moments of despair, when we feel utterly powerless to change our fate. Back to that question at the very beginning. How is humanity going? Are we doomed? 60% of young people say yes. 60% of young people say we have no hope as human, and we're seeing anxiety levels spike around that. We're seeing more and more young people not have children because they don't want to bring children into this world. We're seeing all sorts of mental health crises break out across the world because we feel like we're in despair. We don't need hope when life is going wonderfully well. Perhaps that's why this text, Revelation, has particular appeal for those who know oppression. It is a text for those who are in the minority, for those who feel powerless and face overwhelming injustice every day. The hope that God will act is not an excuse for inaction in the present. Instead, this hope fosters courage in this question to act and resist systems of evil and oppression in anticipation of God's new world. I like to think of myself as toxically optimistic because I believe in a God of resurrection. I believe in a God of renewal. And I think that we are people of resurrection. I think we are called to be people of resurrection. So where do I see hope and where am I seeking courage? I'm going to throw the microphone around in a moment if you would like to share. But two little things that I'm reflecting on at the moment. One is I finished a job this week. Wrapped up, no longer teaching. And I'm starting a new job looking at the NDIS, which is it provides funding for people with disabilities. And I'm really excited to sink my teeth into that, to understand, okay, at the moment it can feel like in our political dialogue that there's reason to despair around the NDIS, but actually it is a flagship program. It is, and there is so much beautiful that's coming out of it. How can we tweak it, engage it so that it is more in line with the values that I hold? And it's quite nice being in a position where I can bring it in line with that. Being able to say, well, what does justice look like in this space? What does thriving, flourishing, what does shalom look like in this space? And so I'm excited to see the goodness that is coming in that program and to be a part of it. And if we were to make it a little bit cheesy, I genuinely see hope in this community. I know it can feel eclectic and oddball at times, but the more I sit with it, the more I see when we rock up together on a Sunday afternoon, when you are in this space, you are saying to Rome, you are saying to Babylon, you are saying to the empire, actually, no. I could do anything with my Sunday, but I choose to rock up and be together with people who want to resist evil, who want to be part of a system that is healing. When you decide on a Sunday afternoon to come along to our gatherings, and when you meet through the week in religious harm groups or community groups, or when you meet just for coffee with each other through the week to encourage each other, what you're saying to the empire is God is moving. And the God that we know is not like the God that so many people in Sydney know. Our God isn't queerphobic. Our God isn't homophobic, is not transphobic, is not biphobic. Our God is building a bigger table. And in fact, when we gather together, we say there is no space for queerphobia in God's kingdom. When we become the largest church in Australia, Sydney's hottest denomination, we can turn around and give a big FU to the rest of the church that said God is not allowing queer people at the table. But we won't do that. We'll turn around and say, join us. We've got something beautiful here. We've got something healthy and healing. And when we pool our energies, when we chip in together, when we rock up, and I think it takes courage to come along to a church like this. When you are here as part of this, what we're doing and what I hope we're doing, maybe we're not, but what I hope we're doing, what I think we're doing, is we are becoming part of that tree of life. We are acting out that tree of life that runs down the sidelines of this river, the river that comes out of the new city. There's a reason we chose New City as the name of this church. This river comes out, and this river waters provides life for these trees, the tree of life on either side of the river. And the leaves of that tree, they get picked in and out of season. And the leaves, this is me imagining what this image is saying, the leaves of the tree get picked and they get put down into a mortar and pestle. And God grinds those mortar and those leaves together, maybe with some water from the river. And the leaves become a balm for the wounds of our nations. Our nation has wounds that run deep. Our world has wounds that run deep. But as New City, as a community, I think that we are becoming part of this balm. We are becoming part of the healing of the nations. I know for a fact that this community has been healing in my wounds. It has been so deeply healing in my journey. I know for many of you, this space has been healing for your wounds, that you've come and found a place where you could just rest, where you could find shalom, refuge. So I'm excited for the future of New City, whatever it looks like in all its complexity, to be a part of that journey, to be a part of the new city coming out of the heavens.